for sure learned from him or from those who learned from him. He was really a giant of a man, a giant and a giant of a Rebbe. I personally had the chance to learn in the Gross Kola, which is YU Smicha program in Israel for 2 years. He was officially the Rosh Hashiva, so I guess I can call him my Rosh Hashiva. He spent most of his time in Gush. He would come give us a shir once a week. But in addition to that, both the Rebbe and both Rav David Miller, the Rosh Kolel, and Rav Asaf Bednarsh, the, I don't know what his official title is, the Rosh Yeshiva YU, but he's there as well. They're both his Talmidim. Rabbi Miller was in his shir for years and years and years. Rav Bednarsh was in Gush for many, many years. So we're here to honor his memory, and there's no real better way to honor Rav Aaron's memory than to learn some of his Torah, some of his thought, and obviously tonight the appropriate thing would be to learn some of his Tanan Zionism. So on that note, we're honored and blessed to have with us for this year and also next year, please God, and specifically tonight, Rabbi Dr. Sam Levens. Sam is a postdoctoral fellow here at the Heiliger Rutgers University in the Department of Philosophy, specifically Philosophy of Religion. He was in Notre Dame last year. Many other accolades he'll tell you about at no point. But we're honored to have Sam with us this evening.
Okay, thank you, and thank you, Rutgers Hillel and Masora, for inviting me and having me. So I feel really underqualified to be speaking about Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, because he was a man for whom superlatives were no understatement. And it's not easy for me to talk about him, and it's not easy for me to think about what it means not to have him in the world anymore. So I'll tell some personal stories briefly, and then we'll jump into some Torah of his. I wasn't zoche to sit in his shir and be a Talmud of his in his Talmud shir. By the time I got to the Gush, he was already quite frail. And he was no longer giving shir, sometimes giving shir klali. So I was in yeshiva when I was 18. I was not in the Gush, I was in a different yeshiva at that time. I won't say where because I'm about to say things that aren't all that nice about it. and for one reason or another, I was lonely in that yeshiva. I didn't grow up so religious, and I decided, as I became more religious and Sabbath observant and things like that, I decided that before I went to college, I should go to a yeshiva. I didn't want to go to a Kiruv yeshiva for various reasons. So I went to a mainstream yeshiva. But I found it much more lonely than I anticipated. It probably just wasn't the right choice of a yeshiva. One day I wasn't very well. So I was a very, very serious student in those days. And I would, you know, I'd be in the Bet Midrash like 16 hours a day and really kind of steiging. I don't have the energy to do that anymore, but once upon a time. But 1 week, I'd probably just driven myself into illness, and I had the flu, and I was in bed for the week. And one of the rabbis of the yeshiva came into my room, and he saw that on my bookshelf. He came to visit me. I was ill. It was a nice thing to do. It's because Mavake Chole, you know, Chole, he was like visiting the sick. It was a nice thing to do. But he saw that on my bookshelf I had a book by Voltaire, and he went crazy, and he opened the window, and he was about to throw it out the window, and I told him, if you do that, like, I just won't talk to you again. So he didn't do it, but I was a big fan of Rabbi Sacks, and at that time, Rabbi Sacks had just written a book that was very controversial called The Dignity of Difference. The book was put in cherem, the book was excommunicated. Like, it once upon a time used to excommunicate people. But for one reason or another, they couldn't excommunicate the chief rabbi of the United Kingdom. So they excommunicated his book. So you weren't allowed to do business with the book. You weren't allowed to talk to the book. You weren't allowed to... All the general laws, right? And I loved Rabbi Sacks. And I saw my Rosh Hashiva, like I said, I wasn't at the Gush yet, throw a book of Rabbi Sacks's on the floor and stand on it. I was just not in the right place. Let's put it that way. And I was lonely, and so a few things I did. One thing I did is I emailed Rabbi Sacks, who didn't know me from Adam yet, and he would reply to my emails, and we became quite close, and he was something of a tonic to me, so, you know, somebody who I could reach out to, somebody who I thought was open-minded and yet really passionately religious, somebody I thought was sincere. And he told me, I was only 18, I didn't know anything really, he told me, you really need to start reading, you need to start reading things that Rav Aaron has written. And I avidly lapped up everything he'd written in English. At that time, The Leaves of Faith hadn't come out, the two-volume book of his collected essays. But almost all of them were already online. They existed, like, on... You could find them. So I read them all. And there was an earlier book, By His Light, a collection of essays. It's harder to find, but I had that, and I lapped everything up. So another detail was... I wanted to be a playwright at that time, right? And I was writing plays, and again, some of the rabbis in Yeshiva said, you can't do that, right? But one of them had the foresight to say, you know what, you should speak to Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, because there wasn't such a thing, and there isn't today anymore, as a gadol hador, somebody who really stands as tall as anybody else in Torah learning, and who, so to speak, had wide shoulders. That's to say, if he said something in Jewish law, then you could rely on it. There was no such figure who was also really immersed in the world of literature and the arts, who really understood literature and the arts. So I phoned him up. I had his phone number. Somebody gave his phone number, and I called him with great trepidation. And his wife is like a formidable woman. She's Rav Soloveitchik's. She's Rabbi Soloveitchik's. She's Rabbi Soloveitchik's daughter, and she's like, "Yes, we got the phone." And I was like, "Speak." He's not in right now. I was like, "Okay, sorry." So that I didn't call him for like another month, because like that was scary. And then I called him again, and he was in. Yes, could I speak to the rabbi, please? Yes, Aaron. And they passed on the phone, and I spoke to him. He spoke to me for a full 45 minutes, and he didn't know who I was. And I asked him things like, you know, can you write a play that has men and women in it? Because we're about, you know, there are laws about women performing and stuff. Can you have a man and a woman, you know, kiss on stage? What, you know, it could be a mother and a son, just like a peck on the cheek. Can that be in the script directions? Things like that. Because, and we spoke about all these things. You know, if something heavy lands on the foot of one of your characters, can your character say the sort of word that a character might if something heavy landed on their foot? Because there are rules about, like, nivel peh, right? You shouldn't say bad words. And I think if you spoke to any other gadol hador, they'd just be like, what are you talking, like, why, like, what are you talking about? But Rav Lichtenstein, he really understood. Also, can you go and see shows in the theatre that will show certain things, especially if you're planning on it being a profession for you, maybe you can see more. He was just very, very understanding. I said a shocking thing, I put it on my Facebook wall, how he said if his daughter had been cast in Romeo and Juliet, he would have done everything he could halakhically to make it okay. So, you know, I don't know what that means exactly. Talk to the director, make sure the costume design was appropriate, make sure the stage directions were appropriate, etc., etc. But he said because he recognised what a transformative experience it can be to be involved in theatre, and especially in a play of such substance. In fact, one time when I was in Kollel and I was learning in Yeshiva, he spoke to a group of Bogrim, and he was shocked when he found out that some of them hadn't read Hamlet. And he said, like, how could you hope to understand Musa if you've never read Hamlet? And then that afternoon, one of the ramim in the yeshiva came up to me and said, Sam, have you read Hamlet? Like, one of the rabbis, like, can you tell me what happens? the gush suited me much better. So I never got to be very close to Rav Aaron. When I was in the Gush, I would sometimes get to speak to him. I'd sometimes walk him home from the yeshiva and would have conversations with him. I'm not sure if he, you know, from time to time even remembered who I was. But he meant a tremendous amount to me because I'm somebody who lives in the world of academia, and yet, like, I want to... preserve what for me is a very kind of childish faith, a naive faith. Most academics who affirm, you ask them what they believe, it's complicated, right? My faith is pretty simple. Like, if you ask enough questions, it gets complicated. But really, yeah, I just believe in Hashem. He gave us the Torah and told us to keep the halacha. And that's what I believe, and that's the kind of Judaism I want to live. And most academics are not like that. And you're made to feel small or childish for having such a faith. But Rav Aaron had such a faith. And Rav Aaron was also a towering intellect, like no other intellect you'd ever know. He spoke about Avraham Avinu. One midrash says that he discovered God at the age of 40, I believe. And one midrash says he discovered God at the age of 3. And Rav Aaron spoke about the two different types of faith you can have. The faith of a 3-year-old, where... And I've had a 3-year-old. I no longer have a 3-year-old. I've got a 1-year-old, a 4-year-old, and a 6-year-old. But I've had 3-year-olds. And it's true. The faith of a 3-year-old is really inspiring because Hashem is a person for them who's just as real as anything else and just as personal as anything else. And the faith of a person who discovers God through arguments at the age of 40, through the cosmological argument, is a very different faith. And Rav Aaron thought that the challenge presented by these midrashim is to somehow embody both types of faith. To be an Avraham who's 3 years old and to be an Avraham who's 40 years old. Anyway, so his existence, sometimes when I was in the Beit Midrash, just to know that he was there, that he was alive, was a tremendous chizuk. Somebody once put it to me that years ago when Rav Aaron was at his height, there was no question at the Gush that anyone was afraid to ask. And the reason there was no question that anyone was afraid to ask was because they knew that Rav Aaron's already thought about it, right? And like, it can't be so bad as to be worth giving up your faith because Rav Aaron hasn't, right? Knowing that there are people like Rav Aaron is just a tremendous chizuk. It gives you the strength to carry on when things get dark. So the world without him, like I said, is a much darker place, and we have a huge burden on our shoulders to somehow dissipate that darkness. Anyway, I wanted to speak a little bit about Zionism, and Rav Aaron. One of the kind of characteristics of Rav Aaron's thought is that it's complicated, right? You like ask him a question, and it's like, well, on the one hand, and on the other hand, and on the other hand, until by the time you've read the whole thing that he's written, you're like, yeah, but what did he say? Because like, and how many hands does this man have? Right? Everything's really complicated. And his Zionism was complicated, and I want to discuss that. But I also want to answer, I hope, is there anything that was simple for him? Right? Is there anything that wasn't complicated? And I spoke briefly about the Emunah Pshuta, the simple faith that animated him. But there's more, I think. Was there anything at the level of the intellect that was simple for him? And we'll engage with that a little bit. So, a little bit of background. I think to understand properly the intellectual legacy of Rav Aaron, you need to understand something about Rav Soloveitchik anyway, but his teacher and father-in-law. But also, I think, you need to understand something. To understand Rav Aaron's Zionism, you have to understand something about Rav Soloveitchik's Zionism. I'm going to say something kind of controversial, but I think you can substantiate it in the text that Rav Soloveitchik published and also in the letters that he wrote that have been posthumously published. There's a very substantive sense in which Rav Soloveitchik was not a religious Zionist, right? That's the shocking thing, okay? He was religious, and he was a Zionist. But there's a very substantive sense in which he wasn't a religious Zionist. What do I mean? There is a brand of religious Zionism that sees the establishment of the State of Israel as part of the messianic story, okay? So we know that the Messiah is on his way. And this Ge'ula, and it is a Ge'ula, because one of the only what Ge'ula means, redemption, one of the things it means is coming back to Israel. There's a Ge'ula in our day and age. But for the religious Zionist, especially in the school of Rav Kook and especially in the school of Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, the state itself, the institution called Medina Israel, is bound up with the messianic story. It's not just a ge'ula with a small case gimel. It's a ge'ula with a large case gimel. It's the ge'ula. The Mashiach's just on his way, right? In fact, Rav Kook implies heavily, if not says explicitly, I need to go back to the eulogy he gave for Herzl, that Theodor Herzl was the Mashiach ben Yosef, because we talk about two Mashiachs that come in the Messianic age, the Mashiach ben Yosef, who's like a prelude to the Mashiach, and then the Mashiach Mamash, the Mashiach ben David from the tribe of Yehuda. Herzl was the Mashiach ben Yosef. According to Rav Kook, World War I was Gog and Magog. Right, so they were living in Messianic times. In Kol Dodi Dofek, the seminal piece of religious Zionism of Rav Soloveitchik, or maybe just Zionism, as I'm about to say, he comes out quite strongly against that view. Not that the State of Israel wasn't the beginning of the final redemption, just that we don't know. It might be or it might not be, and ultimately it's up to how we handle this. We could lose the State of Israel if we don't use it in the way that God wants us to use it, and if we don't make the most of it. For the religious Zionist of the Kook school, that's not even conceivable. To the extent that just before the disengagement, some religious Zionists were saying, the disengagement from Gaza when we gave back land, some religious Zionists were saying, and in fact a major Israeli religious Zionist rabbi with hundreds if not thousands of students was on television saying it cannot happen, and meaning it will not happen. How do I know it will not happen? Because we know that the Messianic kingdom is forever. So it's simply not possible. But it happened, right? And what Rav Soloveitchik was doing in Kol Dodi Dofek is he was almost attacking two fronts. He was attacking, so attacking is a strong word, but he was engaging with those on his right, the ultra-Orthodox, who refused to see the hand of God in the establishment of the State of Israel. And Rav Soloveitchik said, Kol Dodi Dofek, Hashem is knocking on the door. They were like, obvious miracles happening right now, and if you're not grateful for the establishment of the State of Israel, there's something very, very wrong. There's something very, very wrong. But he was also, maybe less obviously, but he was attacking those on his left religiously who thought that Mashiach was a fait accompli. It's definitely, this is it. Saying, no, we could lose this. One of the problems with religious Zionism taken to fervently, is that it can lead, and we'll see Rav Aaron talking about this, it can lead to a certain sort of arrogance, because what you're doing is you're second-guessing God. I know exactly what's going on. God has decided. How do you know what God's decided, right? Just keep your head down and keep the halacha, like, and learn, right? But how do you know with such certainty and such surety what God's doing and what his plan is, his ultimate plans? There's a certain arrogance, even you might say a type of avodah zarah. You have created a pesel, you've created like a set in stone conception of what it is that God is doing in the world, and that's a type of idolatry, not to be infused with a certain amount of uncertainty. So Rav Soloveitchik, why do I say he was a religious man and a secular Zionist? Is his arguments for Zionism fundamentally were instrumental. That's to say, and he says in a letter that's been published in his collection of letters, I do not think that the State of Israel is a chetza shebekedusha. I don't think that it's like inherently holy, the state. The land is, but not the state. But he was thankful to God for the state. That's because he thought that it had tremendous instrumental value. What's the instrumental value? Well, it's a safe haven for the Jews. It's a place where Torah learning is going to flourish. Its existence means, and to use his phrase, Jewish blood is no longer hefker. Right? If somebody tries to attack the Jews, there is now a state with a mighty army that's going to stand up. And these are tremendous things that we should... There were six things, I can't remember all of them right now. There was six knocks on the door, but they're all instrumental goods. And we should be tremendously grateful to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for them. So that's a Zionism, and it's religious, but it's not investing the state itself with kind of an inherent religious value, only an instrumental one. Okay. So here's some stuff from Rav Aaron. Rav Aaron writes an article. It was first published, I believe, in Tradition. I was reading it this morning and I thought I'd never read it before, and then I realised halfway through, no, I've read this before. And it's about the ideology of the Hesder Yeshiva. And in his inimitable way, he lays out the arguments of those on the right who say, you know what, it's much better not to be going to the army. And he lays them out with a tremendous amount of respect, these arguments, a tremendous amount of a degree of sophistication. And he concludes that even though I think they're wrong, this is a respectable position. I can understand where they're coming from. But I'm going to lay out my stall and tell you why I think Hesder Yeshiva is not just bidyeved, it's lechatchila. It's what B'nai Torah should be doing. They should be going to Hesder Yeshivas, a yeshiva that combines study with fighting in the army. And he goes through a number of arguments. There's a mitzvah of self-defense, etc., etc. And then he says, well, maybe Talmidei Chachamim might be, maybe exempt from that if you're a tremendous tzaddik. Who of us can say that we're a tremendous tzaddik? But this is fundamentally his argument. The crux of his argument is right here. In Masechet Avodah Zorah, Yud Zayin Bet, our rabbis taught when Rabbi Eliezer ben Perata and Rabbi Chanina ben Taradion were arrested. They were arrested by the Romans because Hadrian had enacted anti-Semitic laws that prohibited learning Torah in public and performing all sorts of mitzvahs in public. They were arrested for their civil disobedience. When they were arrested, Rabbi Eliezer ben Perata said to Rabbi Chanina ben Taradion, Ashrecha, you're in a good position because you've only been arrested on one charge. You learnt Torah in public. But woe is to me because I've been arrested on five trumped up charges. You read the rest of the Gemara, explains what they were. Rabbi Chanina replied, no, on the contrary, Ashrecha. You've been arrested on five charges, but you're definitely going to be saved. But woe is to me because even though I've only been arrested for one charge, I'm not going to be saved. Because you have occupied yourself with the study of Torah as well as with gemilut chasadim, acts of benevolence. Whereas I occupied myself with Torah alone. This accords with the opinion of Rav Huna. Rav Huna said, he who only occupies himself with the study of Torah is as if he has no God. You see, it's this tremendously powerful statement. You sit in yeshiva all day, and all you do is learn. It's like you don't have a God. It stands in great contrast with, you know, Talmud Torah Keneged Kulam, like Talmud Torah is like worth all the other mitzvahs. It's a tremendously powerful Gemara here. He has a proof text, because it says in Divrei Yomim, now for long seasons Israel was without the true God. What is meant by without the true God, says the Gemara? It means that, says Rav Huna, it means that he who only occupies himself with the study of Torah is as if he had no God. What it comes down to for Rav Aaron, and he puts it in stark terms, it's a matter of ethical principle. The arguments of the Haredim for exemptions from the army, some of them might work. From a purely halachic perspective. He He gives reasons for skepticism about that in the article. It was worth reading. But they might work. But there's an ethical argument that transcends the Dalet Amos of the halacha, which is to say, if there's a national burden, the entire country is carrying on its shoulders a burden to protect itself. There's an ethical principle of gemilut chasadim, to free ride and just let everyone else do it while you study Torah. That's as if you don't have a God. And this is a central theme of Rav Aaron's Torah. He was, for Rav Soloveitchik, it's also true that everything's complicated. Ask Rav Soloveitchik a question, on the one hand, on the other hand. But Rav Soloveitchik, for him, the complication came at the level of phenomenology, existentialism, metaphysics, these highfalutin philosophical notions. They were like embedded in the very nature of reality are these deep tensions that Rav Soloveitchik will talk about. Okay. For Rav Lichtenstein, he wasn't the metaphysician par excellence, he was an ethicist par excellence, right? So for Rav Lichtenstein, why are things always complicated? Not because of the complicated structure of reality, for that's how it was for Rav Soloveitchik, but because of the complex structure of ethical obligation. It's never simple, what should I do? There are always contrary pulls and tugs in the ethical universe. The ethical universe is a complicated place. And in many of Rav Aaron's most noteworthy essays, it's about the relationship between halacha and ethics. And the relationship is complicated. Because on the one hand, there's the narrowly conceived halacha. What am I obligated to do? What am I chayavin? What's kosher? What's treif? What's mutar? What's asur? But there's also lifnim meshurat hadin, going beyond the letter of the law, which is actually a religious obligation. And there's the mitzvah, kadoshim tihiyu, that you should be holy, you should go beyond the law, which is kind of like somewhat paradoxical because the law itself commands you to go beyond the law, right? And then you get into these are called paradoxes of self-reference. But for Rav Aaron, the Hesder question, why it's complicated is because there are conflicting values. There's the value of learning Torah, there's the value of defending the state, there's the value of creating a Torah culture in the state, there are questions of... It's one thing to train in order to be ready for self-defense. That's one ethical notion. But what about giving a tour of duty? So in the way that Hesder works, there are two stages to the army. You do your basic training. Fine, you should go back to yeshiva now. That's done. You're ready. If there's a war, you're ready. But then there's also the few months of active duty. Well, what if there's no war? You really need it? Is that really necessary? So these are kind of conflicting values. And for Rav Aaron, it's always... The question is, how do we balance these conflicting values? Okay, how long have I spoken for? Okay, good. So I'm going to move on. So basically, I think that Rav Aaron agrees with Soloveitchik in terms of what his Zionism is all about. It's not a Zionism of the Rav Kook type. And it's not... And no question is obvious, right? So should we be in Hesder? Yeah, I think we should. But on the one hand, on the other hand, on the other hand, on the other hand, in the end, I still think we should. But it's complicated. When Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated, Rav Aaron was actually in America at the time. But as soon as he came back, he delivered a very, very powerful sicha in the yeshiva. You can find the whole thing online on the VBM, the Virtual Bet Midrash. In the rest of what I'm going to say, I take some ideas from there and some quotes from there. So this quote here is a bit of a segue from what we've been talking about so far to what he said after the assassination of Rabin. There are several points I would suggest as worthy of reflection. First, the self-confidence that arises from commitment and devotion to a world of values and eternal truths, whether in terms of Torah Yisrael or Eretz Yisrael, sometimes has led to frightening levels of self-certainty and ultimately to arrogance. So if you ask a Zionist, should we give back any land for peace in any conceivable possible world? Imagine we had a great partner for peace, right? Imagine, just a distant possible world in which we have a really, you know, really great partner for peace. Should we give back land? And there's one school of religious Zionism will say, never. And why never? Because they're absolutely certain what God's plans for the eschaton is, for Yimot HaMashiach. And this goes against that. Even if it's definitely going to save lives, it's definitely going to save lives. Never. I asked a Rosh Hashiva, not of the Gush, if you knew that it was definitely going to save lives and it was definitely going to work, should you do it? And he said, no. And I said, but is Yishuv Aretz, is living in the land of Israel, Yaharog v'al Yavod, that you should rather die than transgress? He said, yes. And I said, hold on a minute, there are only three things you're supposed... He said, but look, in Sefer Yahushua, we're commanded to go to war to conquer the land. Clearly, people are going to die in the war, and yet God says you should do it anyway. So clearly, you're supposed to die rather than give up land. Okay, to me, it wasn't all that clear, but that was the argument. And I think this is a symptom of what Rav Aaron's talking to, that sometimes our devotion to a world of values and eternal truths, he's not saying they're not true. Torah Yisrael, Eretz Yisrael, sometimes our commitment to those values has led to frightening levels of self-certainty and ultimately to arrogance. This arrogance has sometimes led us to act without sufficient responsibility towards other people, and at times even without responsibility to other values. We are good, we're frum, we have values, they, the Chilonim, they're worthless. This attitude has seeped deeper and deeper into our consciousness. Yes, it's true that these truths are eternal, but it's also true that balancing the conflicting eternal truths is always difficult, and it's always more complicated than it seems, and it should always give you grounds for humility. So yeah, I think this is what I should do, and I'm going to do it, but I'm not going to do it with the arrogance that's associated with complete and utter certainty. Not because we're not convinced about the truth of these eternal truths. Where does the complexity come in? How do we balance all these different conflicting truths? So I said earlier I'm going to address, was there anything simple for Rav Aaron? Yeah, there were quite a lot of things that were simple. Torah Yisrael, Eretz Yisrael, for example. Simple, they're definitely true and they're eternal. The question is, how do we reconcile all the very different things that happen to be true? So, when Yitzhak Rabin was killed, it sent shockwaves throughout Israeli society, obviously, but specifically on the religious-secular divide. To the extent that religious people in the streets of Israel were having stones thrown at them because they were associated with this collective guilt, Aaron Barak, the Supreme Court Justice, when he found Yigal Amir guilty of this assassination, he made it clear that in his opinion, in his official ruling, that he wasn't merely finding Yigal Amir guilty, he was finding the entire religious establishment that created him, the religious high schools, the yeshivas, the teachers, in some sense guilty too, for creating a rhetoric that would sustain or give birth to such violence. And you can imagine how difficult it was as a religious Jew to live through that time. Because to have the Supreme Court Justice find you guilty of the murder of your Prime Minister is a shocking thing. Certainly, in my opinion, it was inexcusable for the Supreme Court judge to speak in that way, because one of the purposes of justice is to begin the process of healing after a crime. So you find somebody guilty, and then but actually his words made the division in Israeli society even starker. But Rav Aaron Lichtenstein comes back to the yeshiva before Aaron Barak has made his ruling, and he says exactly the same thing. He says, we're all guilty. And I think it's completely appropriate for him to say that, because he wasn't standing from the outside, a Supreme Court judge. He was standing on the inside. And the things he said were quite painful. And this is Yom HaTzmut, it's a day of happiness. But I think it's worth just looking briefly at what he had to say, and then I'll wrap up. And don't get me wrong, the secular community in Israel were guilty of terrible things too. And they still are. But it's for them to introspect and judge themselves, and it's for us to introspect and judge ourselves. Before we point fingers at others, we should always be pointing a finger at ourselves. And this is what Rav Lichtenstein said on that day. He quoted the Gemara from Yoma that tells the following story. Our rabbis taught, it once happened that two priests, they were equal as they ran up the ramp. So that there was a ramp. And the first one to get up was able, I believe it's to clean the Mizbeach. Pardon? Yeah, Trim Sadeshen, right? So it would be a great honor to win that race because you get to do a big mitzvah. And two of them were leading at the front. It was Usain Bolt and what's the other guy called? But they were both there right at the front. And both of them were on steroids. Hey, you're cheating. And the other one was like, hey, but you're cheating too. And they said, yeah, but I've got a better cheat. And he pulled out a knife. This would make the Olympics, well, I was going to say more entertaining. No, it wouldn't. It would just be... it would be horrific. He stabbed the other guy in the heart, right? You know, it's like he was trained by the police in Ferguson. Because... no, because he could have gone for the leg. He could have gone for the arm. He could have gone for the ear. Do you know, like, had he been stabbed... in the lip. It would have probably slowed him down, right? But no, I'll go for the heart. How do you apprehend an unarmed man? Stab him in the heart. Okay, so anyway, he stabbed him in the heart. The guy died. Rav Tzadok yelled out. He stood on the steps and he said, our brethren of the house of Israel, hear ye. Behold, it says, if one be found slain in the land, then the elders and judges shall come forth. On whose behalf shall we offer the heifer whose neck is to be broken? On behalf of the city or on behalf of the Azara, of the temple courts? So there's a law in the Torah that if a homicide victim is found and you don't know who the perpetrator was, then the elders of the nearest city have to sacrifice an Egla Arufa. They have to make a sacrifice. And he says, well, who should bring the sacrifice? The elder of the Azara, of the temple, or the elders of the city? And as the Gemara says later, this is confusing because there's a whole thing, Jerusalem is exempt from this anyway, so what's going on? But as Rav Aaron points out, even more obviously, this halacha doesn't apply in this case because we know who the perpetrator was. It was Usain Bolt. Or the other guy. So we know who did it. So this halacha doesn't apply. So what are you talking about? Says Rav Aaron, when a murder is committed... That's not an excuse. We believe in personal autonomy. We believe in personal responsibility. The murderer is guilty. But there is a wider sense in which the society that creates the murderer is guilty too. guilty with a lowercase gimel, whereas the murderer is guilty with a uppercase gimel. G. Gamma. So, here's the question. So, the idea is, that's the reason why the elders have to bring the sacrifice. If you can't find the proximate guilty cause, because the murderer, you can't find him, then you should find the underlying guilty causes. Because they are guilty, just not with a capital G. They are guilty. They've created a society in which such a person could grow up and inculcate such attitudes in a person that they could one day murder. And says Rav Aaron, says Rav Tzadok in the Gemara, sure, halachically we're not chayiv to bring a sacrifice. We know who the murderer is, Jerusalem's exempt. But the halacha teaches us an ethic. This is again going back to this halachic ethical distinction of Rav Aaron. The halacha teaches us an ethic, and the ethic is about collective responsibility. He said Yigal Amir was the graduate of a great yeshiva. He did tremendous things. He went to Soviet Jewry and was running Seder nights and teaching in summer camps. And says Rav Aaron, the day before he murdered Yitzhak Rabin, any of us would have claimed him with pride as a son of our institutions. So it's not okay the next day, the day after he kills Yitzhak Rabin, for us to say, oh, he's just a bad weed. No, if we're going to claim, if we were willing to claim him when he was good, we can't just wash our hands of him when he's bad. We share a collective responsibility. But the question is the responsibility that of the Azara, the temple? This man, this murderer, was a Kohen. He was the product of the temple, this holy place. Or should the city that houses the temple, and for Aaron these become metaphors, the Azara becomes the world of the religious Zionist yeshuv and the religious Zionist school and the religious Zionist yeshiva, and the city becomes the secular state that houses these places. Who's guilty? They're both guilty. There are horrible things happening in Tel Aviv. There's prostitution and there's slave labour of the African migrants. There's Chilul Shabbos. There's Chilul Kashrus. Terrible, terrible things are happening in the city. But we can't sit in the Azara and say, oh, how bad is the city? Because, says Rav Aaron at this time, we produced a Yigal Amir. We're producing right now, and I hate to say it, but I think this is what Rav Aaron would be saying. I know that he signed a letter that very much said the same thing when I was still in the Gush. We're still producing today the price tag Jews. Our communities are. Religious Zionist Jews with kippot and peyot and tzitzit. Peyot longer than mine, tzitzit longer than mine, kippot bigger than me, so they must be frumer than me, right? And they're burning down olive groves, and they're throwing Molotov cocktails, and they're burning people's cars. We're producing that. So it's not okay for us just to point at the city and say, look, what a terrible place. We've got things to fix too. Who should bring the eagle? The Azara or the ear? Both of them. Said Rav Aaron at this time, secular Israel. Rav Aaron was a supporter of the peace process at this time and was a cautious supporter of the Oslo process at this time. And yet he realised that some people on the radical left in Israel were treating the land of Israel as if it wasn't Kadosh, as if this wasn't a sacrifice to make, and were treating the settlers with a great deal of disrespect. Oh, it's not a big price to pay, making people homeless. They were guilty too. But we're all guilty. And we shouldn't just be pointing their finger out. Who should bring this eagle? The Azara or the city? And says the Gemara, all the people burst out weeping. Because they all knew that they were all guilty. And then the father finds that his son isn't quite dead. He doesn't go, "Hey, quickly, bring the defibrillators." He says, "Oh good, he's not dead. That means the knife isn't yet impure." And the Gemara gets into a really interesting question. The question is, what exactly was the perversion that was going on here? Was it that they valued purity and impurity too much? Or was it that they valued human life too little? And the conclusion of the Gemara, of the Amoraim who discussed this, is that they valued impurity and purity the right amount. They were right. It's amazing. It's still pure. But they didn't value human life enough, because in comparison to human life, purity and impurity pale in comparison. And says Rav Aharon, our values weren't wrong. Their value about Tumah and Tahara wasn't wrong. But where life gets complicated is how you put all of your values together. And it's the relationship between the values and the relative import you place on them. What was I going to say? Right, so in the aftermath of this death, they decided, okay, no more races. No more races up the ramp. We'll have a lottery instead, who gets to do Trumat HaDeshen. But what's interesting is we know that before the murder, there was another scuffle in the exact same situation, but instead of dying, somebody broke a leg. So it was the British police rather than the Ferguson police. And the question Rav Aharon asked, well, why didn't they institute the goral, the kind of the lottery after the leg break? Why did they wait till someone died? He said, because the value of the race was an eternal truth. The value of racing up that ramp, the race up that ramp embodied certain values, like zrizus, being enthusiastic, running to do a mitzvah. That value is eternal. And if we can hold on to it, if we can realize it, in any way we possibly can, we will. When somebody died, we realise, okay, not because the value wasn't a value, but because there's a value that trumps it. Today we must say, says Rav Aharon, out of the crisis of the assassination, we must assume an educational and ideological task. Someone may say, the Rosh Hashiva says that the Azarot can lead to bloodshed. Let's close the Azarot. Let's abandon the Mikdash. These places where people believe in God, do you know how extreme religion can get? They'll all be extremists. Close the place down, because as soon as you got yeshivas, you got price tags. Close the yeshivas down. See, we're only a couple of steps away. You know where religion leads? It leads to ISIS. So stop it now, before it gets out of hand. Close the Azaras. God forbid. We won't close a single Azara. Nor will we encourage tepid and unenthusiastic service. We should still be running up that ramp. The challenge is, can we continue to inspire the yearning for sanctity? Shake people out of complacency. Get them to face the great call of the hour, to understand the importance of the Medina, the state of Israel, to understand the historic process in which we live, without losing a sense of morality, of proportion, of right, of spirituality, because certainty and arrogance are toxic to spirituality. Do we have to choose between Azarot and morality? Chas v'shalom. And he says it stronger towards the end of the quote, towards the end of the Sicha. With this, I'll finish. I'll just tie it up. One may ask, but what is wrong with our values? We created a Yigal Amir. What's wrong with us? We try to educate people to strive for holiness, to love Eretz Yisrael, Am Yisrael, Torah Yisrael. Should we stop adhering to and teaching these values? Shall we abandon the Azara? He goes back to this imagery. God forbid, and here it gets stronger, and this is a beautiful, I think, a piece of prose. Not the Azara, not the Ezrat Nashim, not the Heichal, surely not the Holy of Holies, not Har Abayit, not one rung of the 10 rungs of holiness of Eretz Yisrael. And this is a man who at the time was considering a public policy that meant giving up some land. But he wasn't giving up, right? Not on the value. He believed with the purest of hearts that one day Mashiach is going to come and we're going to have the entire Israel, from the river to the sea. Which river? The Euphrates River. He was a man of faith. But in the here and now, maybe I'll have to compromise on territory, maybe I'll have to compromise on Israel, but I'm not compromising on the value. Not the Azara, not the Ezras Nashim, not the Heichal, not the Holy of Holies, not the Rabbayit, not one rung of the 10 rungs of holiness of Eretz Yisrael. But if we indeed strive for completeness, if we want to adhere to all of these values simultaneously, right? Then we must at all times keep in mind the whole picture, the balance and interplay between these values. Have we done enough to ensure that our approach to each aspect of our sacred values is balanced? Perhaps, even if we have indeed taught the evil of bloodshed, we have exaggerated, as that terrible Gemara suggests, the value of ritual purity. So, what is Rav Aaron's Zionism? It can't be boiled down to a nutshell. Is it religious or is it secular? Yes. Is it uncompromising? Or is it willing to compromise? Yes. It's both. And the challenge of Yom HaTzmaut in these complicated times is to celebrate with the purest of simchas this tremendous, the nisim that Hashem has wrought for us in creating a state, whilst never giving up a sensitivity to the complexity of real life. And if Zionism inoculates you to the complexity of real life, then it's another idol. Right? What's simple for Rav Aaron, apart from his faith, were the truth of these values. What was complicated for him was the balance and interplay between these values. So I pray that this Yom HaTzmaut will celebrate with pure hearts and with real simcha. And I pray that Am Yisrael, in the wake of this tremendous loss, a loss that's just it's beyond all quantification. But I pray that in the wake of this loss, we shan't lose sight of this tremendous example, an exemplar of the person who can live in a world with all of its complexities, and yet have the simplicity of the 3-year-old Avraham and his faith in Hashem. Okay.
Our sincere thanks to Rabbi Dr. Liebens. Are you teaching a class next fall?
Yes, but I don't know what it's going to be about yet.
So in case that was enough to make you take a class, I'll be teaching in the fall. We are going to be starting our Marav, or Tefillah Chagigit, and then Marav in about 2 minutes. Booklets will be passed around with the special text that we're going to be using. For those who want to stay, JLIC has condoned it. For those who don't, I guess you're from, that's really from, pardon? Yeah, so Shachar tomorrow is at 8:15, with Hallel and without Tachanun. Hope to see everyone there. Thank you again to Rabbi Dr. Liebens. That was excellent and a fitting tribute to a great individual. We'll pass out booklets now.
What? Is there a wire first? Well, yeah. Wait, what?
We're doing Mars.
It's an intro to Mars. Like, let's leave into it.
Do you want to?
No, then no sucks.
Okay.
I did last year.
Okay.